As we know, our speaker is Peter van der Linde. His title is Recycling and Legislative Initiatives in the Commonwealth Related to Waste Disposal and Recycling. Now, Peter was a merchant marine captain for many, many years. He grew up in Charlottesville. After that stint, he returned to Charlottesville, where he was a contractor, home builder. And as an outgrowth of that business, he created a roll-off container business to supplement his own needs as a contractor. He started Van der Linde Recycling, at least in part, because he wanted to recycle building materials instead of dumping everything into landfills. He built a very large construction and demolition materials separator, and in a stroke of remarkable timing, he did this in the year 2008, just when the big recession hit. So there was very little construction debris and so forth to be dealing with. And so what did he do? He expanded, branched out, and built another facility to receive commingled recyclables and municipal solid waste. Today, about 50% of their intake is construction and demolition materials, and about half is materials, municipal solid waste. And his facility averages something like 800 tons of trash input every day. Now, so this isn't small potatoes or whatever. I'm an Albemarle County resident, and I do read the papers occasionally, and I know that there's considerable interest in the county in recycling and increasing the fraction of our trash that that is recycled in a useful way. And I know that there are plenty of logistical challenges in the county. There are only two places where, if you're so motivated, you can have source-separated, get rid of your source-separated trash. But many of us, for example, myself, we have private trash haulers who are not outfitted to be dealing with separated streams of things. And I'm told that a lot of that ends up with Peter's facility. And I'll be very interested, amongst the other things that Peter tells us, to learn about how much, what happens to that stuff, how much goes into landfills, and how much actually gets sold and recycled in useful ways. So Peter, please tell us many things and finish at least with that. Now, for our guests today, let me tell you about the drill. These lectures are on the Charlottesville podcast network, and part of that is to record the questions and the answers following the talk. And so we'll have lots of times for questions at the end, but I'll call on people that want to ask questions, and before you can talk, you have to get a microphone. And we'll get a microphone in your hands, and then you'll speak, and then it'll be recorded for posterity. So, Peter, would you please tell us lots of things? He brought with him one of his senior managers at his facility, Andy Johnson. Yes, right. So she's here, and they can both handle questions at the end. So thanks. Peter, come on up and talk.
Hello.
Is that good?
Can hear my voice. Again, Andrea Johnson came to our recycling facility about 3 years ago, and she just wouldn't leave. So that's why I brought her here. When I stumble, she'll pick up the pieces. There's a theme, I believe, that I'm supposed to somewhat stay attached to, which is the legislative environment for recycling today. If I stray, and I will, someone has to bring me back to the reservation. One thing I will say as kind of a preamble to recycling in this area, I don't know how many of you have followed us from our infamous beginning in 08, December of 08, when we began, but it's not been an easy ride. not just because of the death spiral of the economy. You know, we built it basically, you know, that said build it and they will come. We built it and nobody came. I mean, it was a disaster. But not just because of that, me, in my infinite naivete, thought currently 98% of all of the area trash was going to the landfill. Not a great idea. When I was growing up, and fortunately I see some kindred spirits in my age bracket, there were 2 billion people on the planet. Now there's 7. So we're not single-handedly saving the planet, but we're trying to leave a small positive fingerprint. So back to my naivete, I thought, well, this is really great. We will divert garbage that otherwise would be destined to the landfill. Hopefully we'd stay solvent to be able to continue to do so, and the environment would be the inescapable beneficiary of our efforts. What's not to like? Well, we found out, and this I'll force this into legislation as best I can, what we learned instantaneously is you do not try to take food off a dog's plate while it's eating. What I failed to realize is that that trash was in somebody else's business model. And to deprive them, even if it was a hole in the ground in Richmond, of that material was not well received. So we had, putting it politely, an uphill battle from day one. And not knowing how many of you read about every newspaper and publication, we had years of intense litigation and huge resistance. And I'm not going to get into all that, not just because they have a gag order on me for it, but because it's really not relevant. What is relevant legislatively, almost uniquely to Virginia, is that we are the second biggest importer of garbage in the country, second only to Pennsylvania. Richmond is just overrun with landfills. So however noble our efforts, we have a distinct lack of legislation that promotes recycling. So there's not a lot to talk about in terms of there's basically nothing other than if our business model can survive, recycling will move forward and prosper. And we're in our 8th year, so Andy knows this. I'm 28 years old. This is just what it's done to me in that period of time. But we've made incredible improvements and expansions to our facility. We're actually shooting a major lengthy video later this month that'll be on our website and available that is going to be up close and personal, all of the nuances and inner workings of all these, you know, new bells and whistles that we've installed. Currently, it's a 23-acre campus out in Zion Crossroads. What drug I was on, I'm not sure, but we've invested $26 million into the technology, and we process every kind of non-hazardous material on the planet. That's the only thing we're not permitted for. We're permitted by DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. They're like the godlike governing body over us. And then, of course, there's every imaginable on the legislative front, state, local, and federal agency, EPA, as I said, DEQ, Army Corps of Engineers, DCR. Of course, we have an SUP with the county, and I think I'm just scratching the surface. So we are appropriately heavily regulated. We are under the same regulations that a landfill would be under. So we have intense scrutiny, lots of spot checks. I would say borderline suffocating level of forms to fill out and all of that kind of bureaucracy, which is a good thing. It's just killing me, that's all. To get me on track and give Andy a chance, do you have any specific questions? Because I will definitely go off the reservation if you let me.
Do you want to talk a little longer?
Sure.
Open it up?
Okay, terrific.
Wherever you go off the reservation is okay.
Okay.
Another 15 minutes.
Terrific. The two, as I said, we really have, trying to dumb it down here, not because you're dumb, just because I, it's an important restriction. We have four areas, primary areas of activity at the recycling center. Of course, the construction and demolition, which is a separate permit from DEQ, and it's, they call it C&D. It's the first facility we built specifically for non-food waste, basically everything that came literally from construction demolition. The second component is the municipal solid waste, fancy word for basically, I'm simplifying it a little bit, household trash and commercial trash. So if I can name what that consists of, but I think we all know, I don't want to ruin your appetite, it's a really dirty business. We also, that same facility does commingled recyclables. That would be what you separate at home, source separated recyclables. And we would, the machine that we built, actually we just completed a $3 million expansion of this machine last year, is equally nimble for in handling commingled recyclables, meaning that's source separated, or all in one, meaning mixed trash. We're often criticized for a lot of things, but among those is that we have some sort of dog in the race about whether things are curbside source separated or whether it's mixed. And nothing could be farther from the truth, because we designed and built this machine, as I said, specifically to be equally adaptable to either, no matter how we receive it. So all we want to do, we don't care how we get it as long as we get it. So we're constantly, obviously, in search of more trash. Currently, we are very blessed to have 800 average tons a day being that we're processing. The last two major components of what we do out there is we crush concrete, brick, block, concrete, rebar, all of these different things, and make gravel. Three different grades of gravel, and we also have perfected our mulch making operation. So we get a lot of wood, and we've got that worked out. None of these things I knew anything about going into this. If anybody's ever driven, this is sort of what gives us the passion, what gives us pride, what frankly keep the psychic income that keeps us going, because believe me, the jury is still out on the financial end of this thing. But if you ever drive to Richmond, on the left, when you get to the 623 Mannequin exit, just before turning right on 280 towards Short Pump, if you ever look to the left, especially with the leaves down, you'll see a giant mountain. And it's a landfill. And one thing you may or may not know, trying to do something here legislatively, is that when landfills, at least in Virginia, I can't tell you that I'm fluent in other states. I mean, I read articles, but I really know only firsthand our area. When a landfill, when they fill the hole in the ground, somebody got the bright idea, well, let's fill the airspace. I don't know if you ever saw the movie WALL-E from Disney movie, but that was the whole movie. They basically filled the air with garbage. So what you're looking at there is a landfill that is permitted to go 300 feet into the sky. And they're at about two. When you look at it, you'll go, my God, you probably, I don't know what you think it is, but you'll know next time you look. They're at about 270 now. They've got 30 more feet to go. But here's the kicker, at least in my mind. It is specifically a C&D landfill, construction and demolition material. We recycle 92-93% of all that material. None of it has any place in a landfill whatsoever. It's not rocket scientist to nail that commodity. I mean, that to me is just criminal. And that's legal. And I'm not trying to pick on anybody, because I'm late to the game. The landfill's obviously been going on long before I was around. So those are the kinds of things that we are unfortunately having to battle for. What we know we're doing a good thing, and but I don't blame or expect major waste companies to go quietly into the sunset. They're obviously publicly owned. They're heavily invested. They have to amortize and keep their business model going. But so there's sort of an inherent tension between these two approaches to garbage. And there are only two approaches. There's only two things you can do with a bag of garbage. Just by coincidence, next door to us is what's called a transfer station. And before we came along, that's all there was. And what a transfer station does is the little garbage truck that comes by and picks up your trash takes it to the transfer station, and they transfer it. They dump it on the floor, and then they load it into a big truck, only for one reason, to more cost-effectively transport it to the landfill, in our case, Richmond. They get paid to receive the bag of garbage by the ton that comes in, and they have to pay transportation and what's called tipping fees at the landfill to get rid of it. Now, here's where we do the identical thing, one difference. We get paid to have the little trucks come in, dump it on the floor. The game changer for us, and I frankly hope for the planet, is our ton of trash. We are, even if I hated the environment, I'd have to be obsessed with recycling, because if I don't, see, at the what they call the back end, theoretically, if I recover 90%+ of it, in this case C and D, I don't have to pay to transport it to the landfill and pay to put it in the landfill. I get paid for the material. So we have our business model, theirs is flawed. Ours is inherently advantaged. Instead of paying to get rid of it, I get paid to get rid of it. And that's why these facilities, I believe, are going to be the landfills of the future. I mean, again, going back to the 7 billion people, we are drowning in our garbage. We can't do this. There's lots of other, we're in a recycling revolution, believe it or not, right now. It's not like the computer revolution, because who the hell wants to sit around and talk about garbage all day? But there's a lot of incredible things going on. We're exploring as many as we can. Want to participate in all of them, anything from anaerobic digestion to all kinds of waste energy initiatives. It's really changing just since we started, night and day difference, so rapid, so dramatic. So that's all very positive. So there's a lot of other things going on other than what we're doing. We just play a supporting role. We're kind of a facilitator. We separate things. That's our goal. We separate them so we can bale them, slice them, dice them, grind them, crush them, however they need to be packed, and send them off to people they call secondary markets that can put them to good use. Should I pause? Andy, do you have anything you want to...
Sure. One of the questions that I get asked quite often is you hear different statistics and numbers being floated around. Some people say, you know, the little bin next to you that you put out on the curb, 85% of that material gets recycled. Versus they'll say, well, you know, with a mixed waste facility like ours, you're looking at 20%. One thing I when I'm talking to people, I always want them to really take a moment to try to get their head around is, in a way, that's 100% true. But if you think of it, in that little bin, the recycling bin on the curb, it's 85% of only what's in that bin. That's only what that person took out and put on the curb. It doesn't count the container, the refuse container next to it, everything else that was thrown away. It's only the 85% in that little container. Because we accept all of it, our rate, we have to count what's in the big container as well as what's in the little container. So we also have a recovery rate of, for recyclables, 80% of what we receive, we are able to recover of the recyclables. But in the way we are regulated, like Peace said, we're heavily regulated, we have to count everything that we receive. Absolutely everything that comes into our facility is accounted for on our state-regulated scales. Everything's weighed in, everything's weighed out. And we have to account for all of that. Another thing that people, well, you guys carry your, or I don't know if anybody does curbside, which bin is lighter? The recycling bin, right? You take it out, it's nice and light. That, you know, your refuse bin, the extra, if you are separating, or for maybe people in the past have done that, it's really heavy. And that affects our numbers as well, because recycling, you know, a plastic bottle is quite light. And, you know, food waste, because so much water content, is quite heavy. And these are things that people, they don't always understand how our numbers work or how we come up with those numbers. And I think that's important for people to understand. And that's, I think it's a little bit, we're penalized just because there's kind of a lack of understanding regarding how we have to report versus how other people have to report. I always, you know, people say, oh, 85% of the recyclables are you know, we recover those. But what about all the people who don't recycle? What about all the people who don't take their recyclables out to the curb? You know, what's happening to those? And that is the basis for what we are doing. We're taking that core concept, so to speak. So you have a lot of communal housing, right? You know, apartment complexes and so forth, where the recycling programs are harder to maintain. You don't really have that. And also curbside recycling. A lot of people don't care about it. They just want their trash out of their house, get it on the curb, and go. You know, Pete had an idea. He said, you know, there's a lot of, and he actually, you know, we'll go and look at dumpsters. You know, UVA, perfect example. It's probably better if he tells the story, but UVA sorts the recyclables, and they actually do a really good job. And they were talking about where to put their residual, which is the rest of the stuff. And you know, there was kind of a bit of an argument, and Pete said, hey, I'll take it. Give it to me. I know there's good stuff in there. Oh, no, I don't think there is. He said, let's go. Let's get in the car. Let's go around the campus. I think, did you go to, what, 4 or 5 different containers? Open it up. By the 4th or 5th one, everybody stopped talking. Recyclables in there. There is still material that that can be recovered, even in residual, even with established strong programs. You know, there is still really good stuff in there. Another thing that I like to mention is, how about the carbon footprint? One huge advantage of having everything in one container. Now, I understand that a lot of communities don't have a you know, $26 million facility to bring their stuff to. So I understand it wouldn't work in every community, but we have this in our community. So everybody puts it in one. That means one truck, not two trucks. You've cut your carbon footprint in half. Doesn't that mean anything? You know, how about the wear and tear on the roads and the extra cost because you have two heavy trucks coming? We also have a lot of people who are rural. They do not have, I mean, they have a hard time just getting one hauler out. You know, they might have a half a mile long driveway or something, and they have trouble just getting somebody out in their area. You're going to get somebody to come out there twice, once for their recycle bin, once for their waste? No. Or if you were able to do that, the cost would be so massive they wouldn't be able to afford it. So these are just concepts I like to, when people ask me about it, just keep in mind, think about it. You know, why did we do this? Or why did we, like I did it, why did Pete do this? You know, what is the core concept behind it? What is the thinking behind it? Because there's a lot more savings than just what is pulling out of, you know, what we're keeping out of a landfill, which is obviously the core recovery. That word is massive. It's the heart of everything we do. But there's other advantages to having just one container to pick up. So,
just to touch more on what Andy was saying about the curbside, meaning the do-it-yourself. If curbside means you do it, our approach, it's called a MRF, a material handling facility, is We do it. Now, we think we do it better, not because you do it badly, it's just that that's all we do. Plus, we got $26 million worth of equipment to run rings around you. It's not everybody's favorite task, frankly. One of the things that really sucked me into this, because I used to sort my recyclables, gave me a freaking brain drain. I could, 7 types of plastic, 4 types of, I mean, cardboard, corrugated cardboard, non-corrugated cardboard, wax cardboard, 7 types of plastic, number 2 colored, number 2 clear, number 1 PET. What, are you crazy? I mean, and I'm supposed to be enthusiastic about this after a day's work coming home and I got freaking mice in the garage, this stuff's everywhere. By the time I got out of church Sunday morning to take it to McIntyre, nobody would get in the car. It stunk so bad. So our idea was to take all the rules out of it, all the do's and don'ts that accompany do-it-yourself recycling, and say, as long as it's not plutonium, bring it on. We'll take care of you. We'll take care of the recycling. And it's really bringing the Industrial Revolution on a very delayed basis to recycling. And that's the only way to really handle the quantity. When you think this tiny little microcosm produces 800 tons a day. So it's really something that has to happen. It is happening. But it's important, at least from our perspective, you got better things to do with your lives and time. And again, I really believe we can deliver on our promise better than you can because you're busy. And it's just something that is unnecessary for you to become fluent in. So we're pretty excited that this is happening. With his permission, I'm going to say yes to you.
So how do you sort all this? I mean, I am a sorted at home. My recycling, when it goes to the recycling place, it is clean enough to eat off of because I have cleaned it. It is ready to go. If everything is thrown in together, there are empty tomato soup cans, gotcha. There are empty this, and then there's nice clean cardboard in the same thing. I have visions of some poor people standing there pulling all this out. How do you do that?
Sure.
And also, Andy, what is your job there? What do you do?
What doesn't she do?
I'm one of the primary managers at the facility. I started out as the sales manager. I still do sales and I do safety, and I am one of the facility licensed operators. We have almost 150 employees, but we have a small core group of management. So we wear a lot of hats. Every manager has their department and maybe a little bit of overflow. I'm one of the primary managers there. So yeah.
She's run hard and put away wet. Hey, to your question, really good question. I'll try to do a 25 word or less retrospective. The very word recycling evokes a vision of people separating things. That's where it's been for decades. Actually, source separation came on about over 60 years ago. So it's been around for a while. So it's completely relevant, I think, understandable that not that people cling to the past, but that's kind of the way it's been, and that's the way it makes the most sense to continue doing. What has changed in the interim, to answer specifically, and I can't go into all the details, but I mean, I'll be glad to, but the technology has advanced dramatically. Take a plastic bottle, and it's got, I don't know, pizza sauce on it or whatever. It's been mixed up, crushed, and come into, we can go right down the list. That PET bottle, a drinking bottle, or any bottle, first in our thing goes through a gigantic trommel. It's a huge tumbler, and it violently throws that around and does first stage, we call it first stage fines removal, meaning it knocks off anything that's stuck in that bottle. Then the next, we call it second stage fines removal, it goes through a polisher, and it's these star gears at high speed, just again, when you see our video here, we'll have it out by certainly mid-April, we'll have it posted. You'll be able to see it up close and personal. And then that same bottle goes to up a fiber screen, and it's on more rubber star gears this time. By the time that bottle reaches the bunker where it's picked by what's called a optical sorter, and that's a brain that's able to identify all the different types of bottles and send a puff of air to each individual one in a nanosecond, sending it to the right place. By the time that happens, that plastic bottle has had the life beaten out of it in terms of cleanliness to the tin can thing. We have multiple ferrous metal magnets grabbing every little piece of ferrous metal, every little tin can. And somebody forget that it came in contact with something in the bag. How about the person never cleaned the out of the can in the first place? It's irrelevant today. When you throw metal into a smelting vat, it's 18,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's hotter than the surface of the sun. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter if you wiped it out with your paper towels. Similarly, you've really got to like take your day and go to a paper mill or a cardboard mill and see how much moisture they can. For example, you know, everybody's kind of, oh, the pizza box and the pizza sauce on the cardboard. And what about the staple in the box, the packing box, or the foam attached to the cardboard, or the colored ink on the Domino's box? Believe me, coming in contact with something that was either moist, again, is the least of their concerns. And again, until you've seen it up, you know, personally, then you get an instant appreciation. You go, it's really a non sequitur. And that applies to each and every thing that we deal with. It just doesn't matter. We have a dryer, for example, for newspaper, it comes in soaking wet. And it goes in the tumbler, and the dryer is dry. Does it make it perfect? No. And there are some pieces of paper that are we consider unacceptable, and they're not included. Because remember one thing: if we can't sell it, we're in big trouble. And if the purchasers, for one minute, get the scent that we're delivering inferior product, they won't buy it. So, again, we're highly incentivized to send them quality product, and that's why we've invested so heavily in the most advanced technology to accomplish that. So I'm not against you doing what you're doing. You make our job easier. Thank you. But it's really not a prerequisite to getting the job done.
I think we're sold. But tell me.
I'm not here to sell you. I'm just...
I mean, you don't have to. It's just amazing. But what percentage of this area is using your facility, and where does the rest of it go? Into the landfill? What percentage?
This is not a perfect
world. You can't name
world.
Names, I'm sure.
Again, we're very fortunate. Five area landfills, our local landfills, have closed. That's a huge advantage for us. We have huge difficulty competing with the landfills. They're cheaper. So the fact that Charlottesville, Albemarle closed, a proud member of the Superfund, you know, the paint pit and all that stuff. I don't know how familiar you are with that. It's a disaster. Green, Fluvanna, Nelson, Orange. Anyway, so that's good. The only real competition we have, to your question, is, as I mentioned earlier, the transfer station right next door. It's owned by Republic Services, formerly Allied, formerly BFI. And they're not good neighbors. They are hanging on to their product, understandably. So we're very fortunate. We have the lion's share. It's approximately a 1,000 ton a day market, and we're fortunate to have 800 tons of that. The rest of it goes to the landfill. We just can't get our hands on it at the moment.
I'm a nurse, and I'm concerned about medical waste, and specifically pills, in addition, because I never make the city drive that collects the pills at the time that it happens. So I have been putting them, somebody suggested, coffee cans and coffee grinds in it. And I was wondering whether that would be better, or using milk cartons, or what is your suggestion for all these excess pills that I bet everybody in this room probably has at least 10 pills that they don't need.
I'm going to let Andy address that, but let's not forget the blood pathogens and the dirty needles.
Yes, exactly.
So one of the things, actually, when Pete was speaking, that when he said we don't accept hazardous waste, I was almost interjected, but he and medical waste. So we are not permitted to receive any medical waste. So, but you're right. We get sometimes, you know, people will have, you know, pills or and different things, and we have to deal with it. We always suggest that you return them to your pharmacy. They usually have disposed. They won't give them to you. So, and then the county has different programs, like hazardous waste collection programs and so forth, that they will accept. It is a huge problem, and 100% it's an issue. We get them. We know. We in our process, most of it just kind of goes through, and you know, nobody's, I mean, a little tablet and everything we do, usually, you know, nobody's going to see. But No, absolutely not in from our facility. Absolutely not. It does not go into the water. Her question was, does it go into the water supply? Absolutely not. At least from what comes from our facility. Regarding a place, the proper place to dispose of them, that's a great question. And, you know, I know that the counties have some sort of like hazardous waste and collection.
I can address that issue. Recently, Mr. Vanderlyn also participated in a community-wide Albemarle study of waste and what to do with it. I actually contacted that committee and asked about that situation, and it is one of the things on their list to look into. It is a national problem.
It's huge, you're right.
Because, first of all, they can't redistribute this medicine. And what did they do if you turned it into pharmacies? I mean, if you look back there in the back of the pharmaceutical department in a drugstore, you wonder how the heck they get all those things in there in the first place. So it is a growing problem, and I suggest that the more you bug your own representatives in any body that governs, the better off you'll be.
And as a footnote to that, doctors' offices, hospitals, clinics, you think you've got stuff, you should see what they try to get unload. And I'm not naming names here, but it is it's a monster concern.
I had an operation a couple of years ago, and they gave me pain pills. I didn't use the pain pills. I never opened the bottle. It was hydrocarbon or something like that, whatever that is. Anyway, I never opened them. So I went back to CVS, and they said no. But the police are having a pickup at Martha Jefferson in a few days. So I went over to Martha Jefferson and gave them to the police. And I don't know how often they do that, but not every Tuesday.
I actually have a couple of questions. The first one is, you said that you're able to recover 92 to 93% of C&D. What percentage of recyclables are you able to get out of the mixed MSW that you're processing? Not the source-separated recyclables, but the MSW?
So also, you have to think of MSW, by definition from DEQ, is not just stuff with food waste. It's not just kitchen waste. So you have to think about that. It's any waste that comes from a resident, commercial, institutional, which would be like schools or government building, and industrial office, so no manufacturing. So C&D actually only constitutes if it's a demolition or if it's a manufacturing debris or construction debris from, you know, like building of a house or a structure. So the and I just say that so you understand what, you know, it's more than just if you're cleaning out your garage. That's MSW. Your basement, it's MSW. It's beyond what is just in your kitchen waste. So just so you know, our facility is, do you want to, 25% is in total of what we get. Once again, that's the residual as well as what we're able to pull out from recyclables is for MSW. That is what our recovery is. Yeah. I'm sorry about that. That stands for municipal solid waste, which once again is residential. It's commercial, so you know Bed Bath Beyond, Kroger, all of those. That is also considered MSW. Institutional waste, so from schools or government facilities. That is also considered MSW because municipal, you have to think of the whole municipality. What makes up the municipality? It's the residents, the commercial, it's the institutional thing. Industrial is not included in that. That is actually included in C&D waste.
Hopefully not to confuse what Andy said, but the challenge we have, given, again, we do both. If you separate your recyclables, it's a no-brainer to get 80% recovery from that because you've done all the heavy lifting. You'd have to be, you know, unbelievably incompetent not to get 80%. We can do the same thing. Our challenge is our recyclables, for the most part, come in mixed. So when we have to report, we report, as Andy suggested, in the range of 25%. I say plus or minus, it's really plus, but 25% is a conservative. And a lot of people will knee-jerk and they'll go, well, they're getting 80%, you're only getting 25%, that must be better. And it's not, it's just that the 80% that they're recovering is from pure recyclables. The 25% we're getting is from the aggregated mass of all the waste. So we're hitting, I don't want to say we're doing better. Nobody knows what percent of the aggregated mass of trash is recyclables. Why? Because it comes from multiplicity of sources. I mean, it may come from the Golden Corral or the, you know, Costco, which is more cardboard. And it's this moving target in terms of consistency and predictability. So there's nobody really on the planet that can say with certainty what percent of trash is recyclables. All we can do is say what of the recyclables in the trash, what are we capable of recapturing and recovering? I hope that makes sense.
Really quick, I just want to throw in one of the things that's unique about our facility, because we have two separate physically we have two separate buildings on our campus. And one of the things about that is we are able to, you know, for curbside recycling, bicycles, bed frames, different things like that, we love, you know, because we are equipped to handle it, because we can handle the, you know, biggest demolition coming down or your household trash, because we have two separate facilities. I mean, it's really amazing technology, what we have out there. I mean, I know it's hard to get your head around if you don't understand it, but we really are equipped above and beyond what normal curbside recycling facilities would accept. We are much more than bottles, newspaper, and and paper. We're just equipped to handle it.
Can you talk a little bit about the markets for the material, like specifically curbside recyclables that you collect, and especially paper and glass, you know, being mixed together and glass getting broken and paper getting dirty and all that. Thanks.
Andy can take that, but I'll just do a preamble on it. One of the things that is just coincidental, I should take credit for it and say what a, you know, clairvoyant person I am. A lot of areas are challenged by not having cost-effective purchasers for all these products. By cost effective, great. If somebody will buy a bottle, but they're in North Carolina we're out of business, because transportation will eat up anything you hope to make on the sale of the product. So fortunately, we have factory direct, multiple factory direct purchasers for, I don't want to say all of our products. Andy can get into more of that. We're constantly working to find purchasers for everything. There's a couple of outliers that Andy will touch on. But when it comes to the standard cardboard paper, I mean, we have mills competing in Richmond and Lynchburg, and we're just very lucky to have that. It was really compliments between the local landfills being closed and lots of secondary purchasers. We're in the catbird seat. I feel very fortunate because it's given us a real leg up on competing with the transfer stations.
One thing is on commodity prices, I'm sure most of you guys kind of know, are quite low right now. Just with the drop in oil prices, that has hugely affected the price on commodities. So that's definitely influences us. We've worked really hard to take out the middleman. In our industry, there is a lot of brokers. We have to deal with a lot of companies that all they do is broker the sale of materials. It's a massive, massive industry. So if we use a broker, so they'll say, you know, we'll buy your cardboard for, you know, X amount, but then they want to make money too, right? They have their payroll to make, so they're going to sell it at a higher rate down the road. Part of our learning and growing over time was to learn how to get rid of the broker and be able to get to the end source directly. And that has been a huge, I would say, leap for us, moving in the right direction. So going to, and part of that was just boots on the ground, going to facilities and just beating the door down. And because there's no handbook on this, really. I mean, you have to go and figure it out on the way. And you see, okay, this broker's completely, fleecing us on our pricing. Can we go to the source? That has been a huge help for us. I think I've completely forgotten your question. I don't know if I've answered it or not, but they...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, with the glass. Yes, glass is one of those commodities. It's quite heavy. So glass is very heavy, and the price for glass is basically nothing. Even for manufacturers, brand new manufacturing companies are not, at the moment, recycled glass is not a huge thing because it's so cheap. Once again, it's all prices, right? Everybody has to make payroll at the end of, you know, the week. So the purchasing of recycled glass has gone down from the manufacturing end of it. And for us, there's not a real good facility close. We do have reuse of glass, and we have, at the moment, we are not selling them for recyclables to make new glass. We are for reuse and just different things. It makes great road, road aggregate. Yes.
Yeah. On glass, again, there are emerging uses as they call glass fault. It's being put in concrete. It's used for sandblasting. Now, this is one of the great example of a frustration. We've got all these others covered. There's two companies called one Reflective and one Synergistic. They buy bazillions of tons of glass. There, one's in North Carolina, one's in South Carolina. I can't access it. So we're really not blessed at the moment in that area, and we wish we were. There are mattress recyclers all over the country. There's not one here. I mean, this stuff drives me crazy. Now, am I going to get dragged into learning how to recycle mattresses? Hopefully not.
I was just hoping that you could expand on your efforts to cultivate markets for your commodities, for the recycling materials. I'm curious to know how you've been addressing the issue with the slump in recyclable prices as of late.
You want to take that?
Yeah, nerves of steel.
I was going to say, he won't quit. He actually, and this is no lie, on his desk, if you walked into his office right now, he has a thing. They're going to have to kill me. That's literally on his desk. He sees it every day because it's tough. We are in a tough market. We have, you know, we have a process that is not labor intensive, but we've got to get in there and dig out. We're basically like farmers. We call it harvesting. So we're basically like farmers. You know, we've got to harvest it. We've got to package it up and we've got to get it to market. And those commodity rates are quite volatile. And because of that, at the moment, it's tough, you know. But as he said, nerves of steel, but just won't quit on it. We've invested too much and feel too passionate about what we're doing.
We call it too stupid to quit.
I want to get my terms right here so I ask this question right. It's a material balance question. And you got weight and you got volume. Landfills are by weight, aren't they? I mean, so as much as you can stuff in that truck.
This area is weight, other areas are volume.
Right. So one of the things I presume you're doing, you're getting the 20, 25% of good stuff out of the 100-pound bag of trash. Gotcha. Are you ending up with much lower volume, higher density at the end of your process so that when it does go to the landfill...
Yeah. That's good. That's very insightful. Absolutely. It's
because otherwise you're not really
fluff. Good. No, it becomes very dense, very heavy because we pull all the fluff out of it, the recyclables.
Okay. That's actually a really good question. And one of the things that everything we do is based on weight. Right. And so our official reporting is all done by weight, not volume. Right. And if it was on volume, it would be a much different scenario. Right. So thank you for bringing that up. I think I failed to mention that.
Follow-up question, nothing to do with that. What's the safety record? The recordables and lost time injuries and that kind of thing over a period of time?
Right now, we are just rocking it. We've done, I have to say, I know. We have a massive safety program. We've just, it's ironic to say we've just finished a complete safety audit, we did just so well. We're very, very fortunate that basically we're what, 90% or something. It's great.
Safety is we have a full-time safety manager at the facility, and where it's an everyday, I mean, I sleep in this thing. It's weird. Every time I go to a grocery store or everybody's asking me to take their shopping cart back, and I guess they feel sorry for me. This old guy, that's his destiny. Safety is a concern from multiple perspectives. Obviously, you want someone to leave with all their fingers and toes at the end of the day. That's number one. But again, as an extra incentive, we have a thing called workers' comp claims, and I won't get into the nuances of that. But it's not insurance, basically. It's just that comes out of our hide. All those injuries. Oh, they finance it over 3 years, but we pay. It's really not insurance at all. And of course, lastly, there's that lovely little thing called personal injury and contingency attorneys. So the threat to our facility, to our continued existence, it isn't just real, it's critical on a daily basis, and it terrifies me. We're in a constant state of paranoia about it because we'll cease to exist in a moment over the silliest of things. What's our record? Yeah, at the moment we're doing okay, all subject to change without notice. Again, it's constantly in our crosshairs. Have we had hits? Absolutely. We had one terrible hit a few years ago, over $1 million, not a lot. You know, if you get a nosebleed today, it costs you $13,000. If you go to First Med, they send you to 5 specialists. I'm not beating up on First Med or anything, but the system is brutal. So you got the unemployment insurance, so you want legislation, workers' compensation, Obamacare kicked in full-fledged. We have 132 employees, so that started full force on January 1st. We're getting crushed. So the last thing that we can afford is an injury. So we're obsessive about that. We have a monthly newsletter focused on it. We're in full just full focus all the time on it.
You've talked a lot about the huge amount of landfills that are all over the place. Now, your technology could, it seems to me, be installed next to a landfill and a conveyor belt set up, and a front loader could dig up and dump stuff on the conveyor belt and run right into a facility like yours. So it seems to me like there might be a potential to tear down landfills in the future. Is that true?
It's true, and it's most prevalent in Europe, where they don't really have the room, nor do we. But anyway, relatively speaking,
There are active landfill mines.
It's called mining the landfills. The problem with a municipal solid waste household trash type landfill, and there are different types of landfills. It's, you know, as I said earlier, there's a C&D landfill, a medical waste landfill. There's a whole different range of them. The problem is that the municipal solid waste, if it's been in there very long, the degradation of the recyclables happens pretty quickly. So your yield is a lot lower compared with your expense of going after it. It's a whole lot easier to go after a plastic bottle when it's just fresh out of the bag of your kitchen than it is to try to dig for it. But yes, that is. And I think that's going to be a growing area of activity going forward. Because they're coming up again with new technology to do it more cost-effectively and profitably. So that's a definite another component of this whole save the planet.
A small part of this, it seems to me, would be electronics. What is the percentage of your business that gets into electronics? And I remember seeing a story years ago about in India and other places where the kids are picking through the garbage trying to get some little bit of metal to recycle. So how do you guys handle it?
We do recycle electronics. We currently are working with a company out of Richmond called AERC and to safely recycle, especially CRT monitors, which are the older, bigger monitors. Believe it or not, we get quite a bit of them still find their way to us. And we work with them to, properly dispose of all of the electronics that are received. Everything's done within the U.S. But we do accept electronics, and we also work with Sims Metal Management, just cords, cables and cords off of microwaves, coffee pots. We cut them and we recycle them. So I mean, we get just bins and bins just of wire and cords. Just from the various things, think of everything that has a wire cut, and it's massive. So it's not quite electronic recycling, but it is definitely, yes, we take it.
Just a kind of an overall comment on garbage that I think maybe you don't have to admit to it, but everybody's been guilty of it one time or another. Even if we didn't have using this example, an electronics program, we have to be prepared for everything, because everything that people don't know what to do with, they kind of look both ways. If it's a can of paint, they throw it in the bag, and they just, basically, everything you can imagine shows up at our doorstep. So we've had to become accepting and figure out, how do you deal with a can of paint? And Lord knows we get tons of cans of paint that they didn't know what the heck to do with, so they figured, you know, no one will see it in this can. And so we've developed DEQ-compliant ways to deal with everything from fluorescent bulbs to lead acid batteries to cans of paint to, so it has to be part of our program, whether we like it or not.
I want to ask a couple of questions. It gets back, you threw around the numbers 25%, 85%, and I understood what that meant. But I'm just curious, as a take-home kind of message about how efficient you are, if you handle a typical bag quantity of mixed household waste. What is your efficiency in extracting the recyclables that are in that, typically? Is it 85%? It's got to be less than that if it's 85% for mixed input.
It has to be less than that because, and again, we're just sort of making numbers up, because in that bag are non-recyclables.
Right.
And it's anybody's guess how many they put in. It varies, but we can, to answer your question as best as we can, on average, about 25% of that bag is going to be recoverable. And we believe of that, we know we can get 80%+ of everything that is recyclable that was in the bag. Why can't you be more definitive? Well, it's just so many variables in the kitchen.
But that's a pretty good number. I mean, if 85% is a good number for stuff that's already that has been separated before you see it, and then you can get 80% or something of the recyclables in this mixed trash, that's pretty impressive.
Although we're never satisfied, we're very proud of that.
But that's a very good number, I think. And so how much of the 800 tons of stuff that you are gifted every day? How much do you send to the landfills every day?
Well, again, you'd have to break that. It goes into the two commodities. We send a lot less C&D because we recover so much more. And I guess I would just have to take a tonnage and apply the percentage and tell you how much. Yeah. But we send more MSW than we do C&D to the landfill.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. And I get one more question because I have the mic, Madison. considering that your recovery efficiencies seem to be quite good for the mixed trash, then I guess that I know the answer to this question. I'm out there in the county and my little trash pickup guy picks up my stuff and we separate our stuff because we just do. But he doesn't care. He throws it into the same truck and it goes off to you. If in fact we had a simple program where people knew that if they felt so inclined that they would put cardboard bottles and stuff in a white bag and the other stuff in a black bag, would that be of help?
Of course it would. We can come up with all kinds of improvements to the existing system. One that Andy has been a big proponent of we codenamed it the blue bag system. Put all the food waste in one bag, everything else in another, as one example. But again, I kind of want to default back to my original comment. We're not setting the agenda here. However it comes to us, we're just going to go after it.
I know, but that's such a simple thing to do, and the private hauler doesn't care. They throw all the bags in the truck anyway, right? So yeah.
Exactly. Now, when it does come in a separate bag, your efforts are not entirely wasted, because it's easier for us to get what you pre-sorted for us.
Do you know of other groups that are either committed, as you are, or perhaps need to be committed, as you are, that are in the state or in our neighboring states?
It's... I could
we
go
are the
for
only,
an hour, that's why.
We are the only mixed waste processing facility in the state of Virginia. That we know of, but not in the nation.
There are monster facilities.
Atlanta.
Of mixed waste. Houston did a $100 million facility. San Diego, Las Vegas, Beverly Hills.
Atlanta.
Gosh, they're just... So this is a... Doing it on a... I mean, we think we're... You should see some of these facilities. They're monsters, and there's a lot of them. And they're trying a lot of different approaches to this thing, but it's a little bit like this mixed waste versus the single stream. Of course, again, we're capable and delighted however we receive it. We can handle it. But a lot of other cities, have made commitments to dip one system or the other, and it's fun watching because all of the trade magazines are just filled with articles about kind of who's winning and the advantages and disadvantages. And so from my perspective, and Andy's such a source of infinite fascination. But the jury is out in terms of what will ultimately triumph as the one-size-fits-all way of handling garbage. And it may not be a one-size-fits-all. There may be certain things that work better in certain areas. But that's in a state of flux right now. It's evolving, literally, as we speak.
A follow-up to Bob's blue bag, white bag. I separated and put in two different color bags. It goes out in my one dumpster. The commercial people come by that have the contract on my subdivision, and the first thing they do after they put it in the truck and the truck begins to get full is compress it all so they can get more in the truck. So now they've ruined all, not all, but much of my separation.
That is such a good question. It's one that I had real misgivings of in our early days of this thing. They call it a compactor truck. So I thought, my God, we do compactor dumpsters under like 1,800 pounds pressure. And I mean, it compacts the stuff. So I thought, oh boy, this is great. We're going to further, it's enough that it's got to be in the same bag, but now we're going to squeeze it. The reality of it is, and you'll see it on our video, and certainly we can, I think we have a tour scheduled at some point, you come out and it doesn't squish it like you think it would. It really does not degrade the material to the extent you would think. The pressures are not as great. It's really just to make room in the back of the truck to put more material in the back of the truck. It moves it forward, but it doesn't just squeeze it. And it was a source of great relief to me when I first saw the stuff roll out. And I was very... plus, another gentleman had talked about there are other materials mixed in with it, the fluff, so to speak. So that tends to give it a little more pushback and a little more resistance to being squeezed.
So everybody did, just hypothetically, everybody who had a commercial hauler collecting in their subdivision or their house, but if everybody did a blue bag and white bag, would that not increase your recovery percentage?
It would make our job easier and increase our percentages. I mean, I'm not going to say if you can get water and food waste and dirty diapers and try hunting season. If you can get that, no, I mean, I can't tell you that it's any picnic and paint and all this damnedest things get in there. That definitely is a step in the right direction, but I'm not here to orchestrate how it's done. We're just here to receive it and try to maximize everything we can recover.
The other thing is, think of all the old shoes, shirts, the Barca lounger, the dog's bed, all these things get thrown into the trash. I mean, so we always think, oh, the plastic of the newspaper and I've got some eggs and some coffee grounds. That's just a small part of it. There's a lot of other stuff that gets thrown away that people would be really surprised that end up in the waste stream.
I'm not going to do a show of hands, but we've all put things in there that we shouldn't have. And the thing that amazes me, I'll see one of these residential rear-loading garbage trucks dump, and I'm seeing Kroger shopping carts, barbecues, as Andy said, Barkle. How did they get it in there? How did they? It defies gravity, some of the stuff that comes out.
All right, one back there.
All right, with respect to pre-sorting, the city actually had a program like that up until about 2 or 3 years ago, where there were actually they had trucks with 4 separate bins, and they don't do that now. It all just goes in the same one.
Do you want to take it or?
Right. I will say.
I'm assuming it goes to you now.
The city, most of it does, yeah.
But not the recyclables.
The recyclables do not. Do not. They go to Richmond.
Mm.
Yeah. Pardon me? No, the city's recyclables go to Richmond.
Mm.
No. That's right.
Now, I actually have a real question. Tin cans. I think it's recommended that you squeeze it so the lid doesn't fall out.
Don't waste your time on that one.
It just goes straight to the smelter.
I don't know who spread that rumor, but it's a vicious rumor. No truth to the rumor. Don't worry about it. I mean, there's no gray area on that one. You're fine. Whether it's the lid's attached or detached or whatever, we compact it in it's called a two-ram baler, and I'm telling you, by the time it comes out, it looks like we crushed a car or something. So there's no, it's highly dense and gets it off.
I'm old enough to remember in World War II, you cut out the bottom of the can and put the lids inside and squashed it.
You just answered the question I was going to ask, but I have another question. Do you accept individuals coming with material?
Yeah, we call it Piper Cubs and Jumbo Jets. We take, we've got a $6 minimum. We call it $6 Saturday, although our hours are from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're open 13 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and 6 to 2 on Saturday. And we'll get a lady with her two kids and one bag and a Prius versus a demo truck everybody's welcome. We wanted to provide no rules, no restrictions, because all recycling's good recycling. In addition, for those that want to separate, we have like a mini McIntyre free to the public where people can put their stuff in, source separated. Of course, we take those cans back, dump it on the floor, and feed it through the machine, because there's always somebody, however well-intended, that puts the wrong stuff in the wrong, so it's got to be run anyway. But again, we just try to say yes, and then so that everybody feels welcome. They all get a free bottle of water, a smile, and we unload their vehicles for them. They don't even have to get out of the car.
In the city, they have, for people who accumulate large items, they have a large item pickup. What do they do with that? Does that just go to the landfill, or does
anything?
They
bring it to us.
They bring it to take it to you?
Yeah.
Well, excellent.
Could the senior center have a bus tour out there?
There's actually, we coordinated with Rich to have a tour. The tour date has been set. We can't take a busload at a time. When you come out, you'll see anybody who's been out to our facility is really busy and a lot of heavy traffic, heavy trucks. We just can't take that tour size at one side. Our normal tour group size is about 5. We can go maybe 7, but if there's a lot of people who want to come and there's not enough room, we can look at doing an additional date for tours. We love to. It's I think it's like 8 o'clock. But see, we open at 6 a.m., so 8 o'clock, we've already been rolling for a while. Oh, of course, not 6 o'clock, but 8, 8 o'clock is, I think, the tour time that we have coordinated.
Again, it's an industrial environment. It's hard hats, safety glasses, steel-toed boots, fluorescent vests. It's that thing we chatted about earlier. Personal injury is an extreme concern of ours, and things can happen pretty quickly. So,
most of us have pets. We have all our little baggies and so forth. Would it help to put that in a separate bag or just pitch it in?
Our process is such that when it comes in, it just goes directly on a residual belt, and so it's not handled. How you're doing is fine.
Do you have tours for children? Years ago, I did a wonderful program with a group of Cub Scouts in Connecticut. Our focus was what happens when you throw something away. And we went to recycling centers. We did everything. And it was so impressive, not only what the kids learned and how they, at least for the while, talked about not throwing things away, but their parents were very much taken with this and with the need for watching what you're doing and what you're buying and all of this. So do you take kids?
That's one of the things we get a lot of calls for groups of children, school groups and Boy Scout groups and so forth. Our group size, once again, our tour size normally is 5. And most people have tour, it's like a classroom or something. It's 30 kids is just too difficult for us. We have to be respectful of our insurance provider, their regulations for our liability insurance. We can't have small children running around a trash facility. And so it's difficult. We haven't gotten to that. One of Pete's thing, I don't know if he's going to expand on it. One of the things we'd like to do is make a window area where elevated so you can look from the top down and see all the processes as they're working. We just haven't gotten to that point, but we'd like to, but not able yet.
I think if the kids could see the live action from a skybox, you know, I got to have basically bulletproof glass, stuff's flying around, I think it would make the recycling much more of a connect-the-dots relevance to them, and not just, I separate the stuff, but what happens next? I think that live action, that's something, all it needs is money right now, is something I want to have and do field trips to all the schools nonstop. I think it would be a wonderful adjunct in, from an educational perspective.
I just wanted to say that you have a great video on your website showing your big machine, and I guess the next video will even be better. So why don't you tell us your website?
Oh, right. It's vanderlindarecycling.com.
It's our name, vanderlindarecycling.com, and, you know, www.
Who are your customers? County Waste, Time, and where does McIntyre take their stuff?
Right. At the moment, we're blessed to have everybody as our customer except, as I mentioned earlier, Republic Services, and then the McIntyre material is handled by the Ravenna Solid Waste Authority. They take it somewhere. I don't know where.
You don't know where they take it? I bet you do.
Actually, they're not very forthcoming in share.
One of those things that you don't want to say about your competitors.
Oh, no, no. No, the truth is we're constantly striving to, you know, work with our competitors and try to form partnerships. They're a little bit proprietary on that stuff. So I'm sure you could get it through a FOIA request. You know, it's public information.
Peter and Andy, thank you very much. We've learned an awful lot.